every Friday at 10 and 2200 UTC right here on VOA 1 with yours truly, Nikki Strong. Join me.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and John Russell. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
Taiwan's exports are growing at a time when the world economy is shrinking because of the COVID-19 health crisis. Taiwan reported a 6% jump in exports from July through September of this year. Experts say the jump is most likely a result of increased orders from technology businesses in mainland China. They say Chinese technology companies are buying up computer chips or semiconductors made in Taiwan. Taiwanese factories produce some of the world's top computer chips. But during the past 4 years, Taiwan has pushed companies to depend less on the Chinese market. Taiwan and China have been locked in a political dispute for over 70 years. The two sides separated in 1949, when the Chinese Communist Party took control of the mainland and the Nationalist Party moved to Taiwan. China claims sovereignty over the island, but Taiwan rejects the mainland's call for unification. Now, China wants to develop the latest telecommunications technology, known as 5G. It also wants to be a powerful force in the technology field worldwide. Alicia Garcia Herrero is chief Asia-Pacific economist with the French investment bank Natixis. Of Chinese companies, she said, they know they're not able to produce at least the highest-end semiconductors needed for 5G. She added that Taiwan makes top-level semiconductors and is unlikely to give up as a leader in the field. Technology equipment is Taiwan's top export to China. Information and communication technology products make up half of Taiwan's total exports. Between July and September, $27.2 billion of Taiwan's $90 billion in exports went to China. Those numbers come from Taiwan's Bureau of Foreign Trade. Chinese importers bought more than one-third of the $32.9 billion in exports from the grouping of products that include semiconductors. Taiwan's government-supported central news agency says September export data showed rush shipments from Taiwan to two major Chinese companies. They are Huawei Technologies and China's biggest chip factory, Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company Limited, TSMC, is the world's largest contract chipmaker. From July to September of this year, 22% of the money TSMC earned came from China, a company official said. Exports fueled Taiwan's economic growth in the same three-month period, rising 3.3% compared to the period last year. The government is predicting a growth rate of 1.56% this year. Both these numbers stand out because the International Monetary Fund predicts the world's economic activity will fall 4.9% this year. Brady Wong works in Taipei for the market intelligence business Counterpoint Research. He told VOA, a lot of these goods are being sold in China because China is actually stockpiling inventory. Wong said the reason for the move was the state of relations between China and the United States. The two sides have been involved in a trade dispute for more than 3 years. The U.S. government also considers Huawei a security threat. The reason for stockpiling is the recent state of Sino-U.S. relations, not just Huawei, Wong said. Chinese businesses traditionally look to California's Silicon Valley for the latest in technology. Last Tuesday, Huawei Technologies released a statement about the sale of part of its smartphone business. The company said sale of its products to the public have been under tremendous pressure because of a lack of technical elements needed for its mobile phone business. Chinese tech companies are trying to depend less on foreign suppliers and ideas. They describe this as a move toward self-reliance. China eventually hopes that it can make everything it needs within its own borders, Wong said. But he said it will depend on foreign ideas and supplies for some time. Self-reliance from China doesn't mean full self-reliance because they're not yet ready, and I think that's going to boost in a way that semiconductor industry even further in Taiwan, noted Garcia Herrero. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
A new report says English proficiency is improving in many parts of the world. The report, the 2020 English Proficiency Index, or EPI, is a yearly look at English levels around the world. This year, the study was based on data from more than 2.2 million test takers in 100 countries. Education First, or EF, a private company, led the research and reported the findings. The study found that proficiency test results from 26 countries improved by a significant or large amount, while only 7 countries had large drops. The Netherlands had the highest level of English proficiency, while Tajikistan had the lowest. Europe had the highest proficiency scores of any region. Within the continent, Northern European countries had the best ratings, with the Netherlands, Denmark, and Finland at the top. The report notes that schools in Northern Europe have high levels of English proficiency for several reasons. They include early attention to communication skills, daily speaking and listening in English, and career-targeted language teaching. The report notes that not all countries have the same proficiency levels. France, Spain, and Italy still fall behind most other European Union states. However, English proficiency levels in France have improved over the past 3 years. In Turkey, proficiency levels improved a little compared to 1 year earlier, although they have dropped from 5 years ago. The report suggests that Turkish schools spend too much time on English grammar and translation rather than useful communication skills. Asia had the second highest regional score behind Europe. But the EPI report notes that Asia has room for improvement. Despite major investments in English education, the average English proficiency score in Asia has remained stable for the past 5 years, the report said. Asia has the widest differences in English proficiency levels. Singapore had the highest score among Asian countries, coming in at number 10 in the world. Yet several Central Asian countries were toward the bottom of the list. Their low rating, the report suggests, is partly because Russian is the second language that is most commonly taught in schools. Africa came in third in regional scores, with South Africa in the lead. The report notes that proficiency test results across Africa were uneven. Kenya and Nigeria were also in the upper part of the EPI list, while other African countries were much lower. One limitation is that EF only had enough data to include just 13 African countries. There may, in fact, be a wide gap between high and low proficiency countries, the writers of the report said. But they add that there could also be less of a difference in skill levels than the data suggests. The new report noted the success of English teaching programs in Latin America. Investment brings results, the report said. Argentina had the top score in the region. Most of the Latin American countries listed in the study improved their adult English proficiency levels. 12 of 19 countries noted improvement, and 4 had significant improvements. The report suggests that the Latin American business community has increased its demand for English speakers. In return, many of the countries have made improvements to English teaching programs. However, the report says that it is too early to judge these reforms based only on adult proficiency levels. Overall, the Middle East had the lowest English proficiency of any area. Iran had the top score in the Middle East, while Iraq had the lowest. The report notes that, in some countries, the problem appears to be uneven access to English education resources. But in other countries, the arrival of large numbers of refugees has resulted in resources being moved toward basic services. The new EF-EPI is based on data from test takers who took the EF Standard English Test, or EF SET, or one of EF's English placement tests in 2019. The EF SET is free and online. Most of the test takers were working adults or young adults finishing their studies. Only cities and countries that had at least 400 test takers were included in the EPI. The report notes that there are some limitations to the study. Since the testing was online, people without internet could not take the tests. It is likely only those who want to learn English were tested. Their English proficiency scores could be lower or higher than those of the general population. I'm John Russell.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. On March 4th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president after winning a second term. The election had taken place in the Union of Northern States. The Union still followed the United States Constitution. The Confederacy of Southern States had left the Union. The South had its own constitution. On the evening of Inauguration Day, the White House was open to the public. The party ended near midnight. Thousands of people went to see President Lincoln. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of President Lincoln and the American Civil War.
Lincoln was glad the celebrations were over. Now he could get back to the urgent problems that faced him. He hoped that during his second four-year term, he could end the Civil War. He hoped he could ease the bitterness and hatred the war had brought. Lincoln hoped for an easy peace. He wanted no hangings or other brutal acts against the losers. He wanted to see Confederate soldiers go back to their homes to become peaceful citizens of a united country. Lincoln wanted the nation to grow together again.
The war could not last much longer. The South already was defeated, but Confederate leaders refused to accept defeat. General Robert E. Lee's army still held the area around Richmond, Virginia. Richmond was the Confederate capital. Lee did not believe, however, that he could hold the city much longer. His once mighty army now had less than 50,000 men. These men were tired and hungry, and they had to defend a line almost 60 kilometers long from Richmond to the city of Petersburg. There just were not enough Confederate soldiers left to fight.
Lee decided that his only hope was to give up the two cities. He would march south and join General Joe Johnston's army in North Carolina. Perhaps the two armies could defeat Union forces moving up through the state. Then they could turn to meet the army of General Ulysses Grant. this plan had little chance of success. But it would keep the Confederate armies active for a few more weeks or months. Lee soon discovered that it would not be easy to break out of the trap that Richmond and Petersburg had become. Grant's army seemed to be everywhere. Lee put 11,000 of his men into position near Grant's line. They waited for the enemy to attack. At first, the Confederates received some help from the weather. Heavy rains fell for more than a day. Many roads and fields were flooded. The Union Army could not move forward. When it did, the Confederates were ready. They pushed back the attackers.
The victory did not last long. There were five times more Union soldiers than Confederate soldiers. The Confederates fought hard, but could not stop them. They were forced to withdraw. The Confederates moved slowly, then more quickly, as Union troops chased them. They began to flee wildly. About half of them were captured. Grant ordered an immediate attack all along Lee's line. He was sure the line was weak. He was sure he could break it. A Union Army doctor watched the battle from a distance. He said he could see the flash of light from Confederate guns along a line a kilometer long. After a while, part of the line went dark. Then another part, and another. Flashes of gunfire became fewer. Finally, all of the line was dark. The doctor said he knew then that the Confederate line had fallen.
General Grant had been trying to break General Lee's line for almost a year. Now he had done it. His troops raced forward to seize the railroad. Lee no longer had a way to supply his troops in Petersburg. He no longer had a quick way to move his army south. He would have to move west first, then turn south. This meant he would have to give up Richmond. The government of the Confederacy would have to go with him or be captured. Confederate President Jefferson Davis gave the order to go.
Southern soldiers began to burn military supplies they could not take from Richmond. Huge amounts of shells and gunpowder were exploded. The fires got out of control. Many buildings burned to the ground. The streets were filled with refugees trying to escape the burning city. Mobs broke into stores looking for food. Union troops quickly moved into Richmond. Then they raised the United States flag over the once proud capital of the Confederacy.
President Lincoln visited Richmond on April 4th. He visited the Confederate State House, where the rebel Congress had met. He had lunch in the Confederate White House, where Confederate President Jefferson Davis had lived. Everywhere Lincoln went, hundreds of people crowded around him. Blacks, especially, wanted to get near him. They wanted to touch the man who had made them free. At no time was any kind of hostile act made against the president.
In the next few days, Lincoln followed carefully Grant's campaign against Lee's withdrawing army. By telegraph and messenger, he was informed of every move. Lee's men marched without food. They did not have time to search for it. They could not stop. The Union Army was only a day behind them. On and on they marched, many of them, weak from hunger and tired beyond belief, could go no farther. They left the road to sleep. Most never got back. Others continued to march. But many threw down their guns and equipment. Union forces attacked the moving line when they could. There were battles at such places as Amelia Courthouse, Sailor's Creek, High Bridge, and Farmville. Lee's army fought off each attack, but it was slowly bleeding and starving to death.
Lee asked one of his officers to report on the situation. "There is no situation," the officer said. "Nothing remains, General Lee, but to put your poor soldiers on their poor horses and send them home in time to plant the spring crops." Lee answered, "What would the country think of me if I did that?" "Country?" the officer cried. "There is no country. You are the country to these men. They have fought for you, without pay or food. There are still thousands of us who will die for you."
On April 7th, General Grant sent a message to General Lee. He said it was hopeless to continue the struggle. He asked for the surrender of Lee's army. Lee did not agree that the situation was hopeless. He believed there was still one small chance to escape. He wanted to reach a place called Appomattox Station. There, his men could get food. Then they could march to Lynchburg, where a railroad would carry them south to safety. But the Union Army reached Appomattox Station first. Lee and his officers decided to make a final effort to break out of the circle of Union forces. If their plan failed, Lee would have no other choice. He would have to surrender.
Lee rose early on the appointed day. He put on a new gray coat and a bright red sash. He looked as if he were going to a parade. His officers wondered. Then Lee explained, "I probably will be General Grant's prisoner. I thought I should look my best." At sunrise, Lee arrived on a hill outside the town of Appomattox Courthouse. He looked down on what was to be his final battlefield. His men fought hard and well, but they could not break through the Union line. Finally, Lee said, "There is nothing left me but to go see General Grant, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths. Lee was sure Grant would not demand unconditional surrender. He said, "Grant will give us good terms, as good as we have the right to demand. I can surrender this army on the condition that its members will never fight again." Lee turned his horse toward the enemy lines behind his army. He sent a message to General Grant. It said, "I now request to meet with you at such time and place as you may name to discuss the terms of the surrender of this army."
The place would be a home in a town called Appomattox Courthouse.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.